4 presents The Mark Steel Revolution, a series of lectures on revolution. This week, the sexual revolution.
What was the sexual revolution about? Your view on that probably depends on how old you are. If you were 40 or more in 1968, you might well imagine that it was just an explosion of debauched immorality that's gone on ever since, with everyone having sex and just not giving it a second thought. But if you were about 20 in 1968, you'd probably imagine that the way the older generation had sex was like this.
I was wondering, dearest, as it's Tuesday, perhaps it would be an idea to have relations.
Certainly, darling. That would be most pleasant.
Then I'll just finish this article about Hugh Gateskill and put my pipe out. There. Now let's get undressed. Not forgetting to leave each item of clothing folded neatly. Right. All present and correct? Put the light out. Then let's begin.
Tell me, darling, have you started yet?
Indeed I have.
In this programme, I will be arguing that the sexual revolution was about much more than increasing your chances of getting off with the art student after a David Bowie gig. In fact, it was about changing the world in a great many ways, one of the least important of which was sex. The world it sprang from was the world of the 50s and 60s. So, for example, for the older girl, there was a book called In Search of Charm by Mary Young, published in 1962, which advised teenage girls on how to behave with young men.
Keep pace with what's going on by reading the headlines and the important articles in the daily newspapers. I knew a girl who travelled regularly from Tunbridge to London, and one morning, on her usual train, she met an extremely nice young man. She was delighted when he struck up a conversation, but when he said, "Wasn't that a terrible disaster last night?" she just sat there thinking, "Terrible disaster?" But she had no clue. Do you see?
So girls in 1962 must have gone, "Oh, an earthquake in Peru's killed a million people. That's handy, I've got something to talk about to that bloke on the train." The argument that a woman's place is in the home was backed up by the law. In the mid-60s, women's wages were on average just over half of men's. Most women's work was low-paid, part-time or working from home, and only 15% of managers were women. In America, it was even worse. Only 1% of judges and 7% of lawyers were women. Women weren't allowed to buy a house or a car on credit without a man, and in Arizona, it was illegal for a woman to swear. In Britain and America, the ideal place for a woman was described in an influential book by Reverend Tyler called Sex, Marriage and Control, which explained that you should always make sure that you
don't incur social obligations which make inroads on your time. I assure you that afternoon tea or whatnot is no excuse for there being no dinner ready, time after time when a husband comes home.
So it's not surprising that a typical comment in a series of interviews about life in the 60s for a book called Women and Their Families is from a Mr. Trickett of Preston, who said,
"I was the old-fashioned type. My dinner had to be on the table at 12 o'clock and my tea at 5:18.
So at 5:17 every day at the Trickett household, it must have been like a Preston version of Ready, Steady, Cook. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, time's up, you failed again, you lazy bag. It's 5:18 and you're still pouring gravy, I'm starving. I wonder if it was dished up at 5:17, if he'd say, "I don't want it now, I'm not hungry yet, woman." According to an Italian saying that was used at the time,
"A good wife is an angel in the street, a saint in the church, a careful housekeeper, and a living picture as she stands framed in the window awaiting his return."
I wonder if there's a special Sicilian version that ends and can waste a hostile witness with a 22 from 60 yards and then do the dusting. Looking like a living picture meant looking above all else feminine, preferably blonde, a fashion which came from America in the 50s. In 1956, 30% of American women dyed their hair blonde. In a New York hospital, the doctors couldn't get women with cancer to take a drug which could save their lives because the side effects were said to be unfeminine. And eating a chalk called Metrical became hugely popular as it stopped women from feeling hungry so they could shrink to the size of models. And here we are, just 40 years later, and that's almost impossible to imagine, isn't it? advice to women was to give a sharp daily pinch to each ankle to stop unsightly flab at the bottom of the legs. The idea was that then nice young men would say, oh, hasn't that woman got shapely slim legs? I could quite fancy her if it wasn't for the massive black and purple bruises on her ankles. In these conditions, sexuality was frowned on, especially women. So Anna Coote, in her book Sweet Freedom, quotes a sex education guide for boys of the time.
Girl sensations are different from yours in that they tend to be rather vaguely spread throughout the body and seem to most girls rather like looking at a beautiful sunset.
Which means that during sex, if a woman goes, oh, look, you can see Canary Wharf in the distance, that's a compliment. But advice to adults was just as unhelpful. In Sex, Marriage and Birth Control, the Reverend tells women,
keep your nails carefully and closely trimmed. There are many men who are rendered temporarily impotent by the sight of long nails on a woman. Equally disgusting is the colouring of nails that some women are allowing themselves to effect. Why, some evil deity alone knows.
But even more importantly,
most of the time your sexual embrace will be engaged in while lying face to face. It will not be an ideal experience unless there is sweetness of breath. An unpleasant breath may arise from a disordered stomach, so at least one free movement of the bowels should be the daily rule.
What must his own life have been like then? And also, if he came out of the toilet and went, oh, I'll tell you what, darling, I wouldn't go in there for the next half an hour. She must have gone, whoa, I'm up for one tonight. And worse, life and our children advised parents,
the teenage boy may discover that he's had an emission in the night called a wet dream. This presents no problem and is merely a sign that he is growing up, as long as he gains no pleasure from the experience. Before bedtime, the boy should be encouraged to take strenuous physical exercise, which will ensure a deep sleep, untroubled by dreams. Deliberate masturbation is, however, a great sin, and after consultation with his teacher, it is wise to obtain medical advice and, if necessary, skilled psychiatric help.
But there was one group who stood furthest of all outside the confines of the perfect family, gays. In America in the early 1960s, the New York Times published an article which became accepted by most of the medical profession, written by two psychoanalysts called Irving Bieber and Charles Socarides. The article ended by saying that the homosexual is ill, and anything that tends to hide that fact reduces his chance of finding treatment. Be great if it was true, though, wouldn't it? You could just ring up work and say, oh, Mr. Simons, I won't be in today, I've got a touch of homosexuality. I should be all right by tomorrow, though. And could it suddenly go round to loads of people at once, like the flu, so if you told someone you'd got it, they'd say, oh dear, well, there is a lot of it about. Everyone seems to be going down with it at the moment. A 1958 book called What's Happening to Me talked about what it called same-sex friendships among adolescents.
Fortunately, most young people grow out of friendships of this nature. If not, you should speak to your rabbi, priest, or scout leader.
Priest or scout leader? That's like saying, if you're worried that you may be growing up into a criminal, you should speak to Reggie Cray or Mad Frankie Fraser. In England, the law on homosexuality was based on the Offences Against the Person Act of 1861, which read,
whoever shall be convicted of the abominable crime of buggery, committed either with mankind or any animal, shall be liable, at the discretion of the court, to imprisonment for life.
Any public gay act, even holding hands, would be almost certain to result in arrest. And in America, the New York police had a system of wandering around gay areas, arresting them two at a time, and chaining them to telegraph poles until they had a van full which they would drive back to the station. The dominant attitude in England seemed to be that as it was a sickness, it was all right, as long as it was never mentioned. So gay clubs in England would be full of men trying to be as respectable as possible, anybody flamboyant would be barred, and the entertainment was ballroom dancing. Then, if the police raided the place and said, strange, a room of uneasy-looking people dressed very smartly and not a single woman, they could just say, yes, officer, it's the annual general meeting of the MCC. Lesbians didn't even have that, and the general view seemed to be that they didn't really exist. But Britain was changing. In 1939, there were 69,000 students in Britain, mostly the sons and daughters of the rich. But with the boom and new technology demanding a much more educated workforce, by 1964 there were 294,000. This was a generation that was learning ideas and wanted something better. And maybe, most importantly of all, this new generation was the first to have independence in their youth. With money, teenagers could go out without their parents and develop a whole culture that wound their parents up. Some of them could even afford a car, which opened up a whole new world of possibilities for sex, which shows how repressed people must have been. That they could see an object, 8 foot by 6 foot, with a dividing wall between front and back, a stick poking up in the middle of the front section, and the top half almost entirely made of glass, and think, God, we can have sex in that! Something else was making it possible to think of sex as something that could be enjoyed outside marriage. Contraception. Before the 60s, one of the most recommended methods of contracepting was called douching. This was supposed to be done by the woman immediately after sex using A, a quart of warm soapy water, or B, a quart of warm water into which the juice of a lemon had been squeezed, or C, a quart of warm water into which a half cupful of vinegar had been stirred. It sounds like they should have had recipe programmes on the home service.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Mrs. Bunyan's Country Contraceptive Recipes. Tonight, we're going to make a lovely post-coital douche mixture out of warm water and lemon. Now, I know lemons are a little scarce at the moment, so if you can only get lemon powder, that will do nicely.
And then at the end...
There! Isn't that lovely? Now, can I invite you, madam, sitting there in the front row, to come up and try some? There we are. What do you make of that?
Condoms were becoming available, but the government didn't officially sanction them until 1967, so they were seen as somewhat sordid. And it was also strange that one of the main places they were available was the barbers. How did this happen, then? Who was the first weird barber who thought, I must branch out from haircuts? One of the most common forms of contraception was withdrawal, which was summed up by the euphemisms that people had for it. For instance, in the Northwest, people would say, we stop off at the roundabout instead of going all the way into Morecambe. But the big turning point was the pill. No longer was it easy to believe that any attempt to prevent pregnancy was interfering with nature. There was no lemon, no vinegar, no sponges, no wandering around with an unwanted crew cut because you've had to cut your hair twice a week. Just a pill. Now, the experience of the war, new trades for working women, the growth in higher education, teenage independence and the pill were undermining all the old attitudes towards sex and helping to create a revolution. The first sparks of the sexual revolution were confined to the middle classes and students. In 1966, a pair of sex therapists called William Masters and Virginia Johnson compiled an enormous study from interviews with thousands of women showing how women could have better orgasms. A crop of books followed, especially from America, with names like Liberating Masturbation by Betty Dodson. The first English edition of Reich's The Function of the Orgasm became a bestseller. Anna Kurt wrote a popular pamphlet which said, "We must demand a change in the standard sexual positions." Demand? What, like a shop steward?
Come in.
Right. My sisters and I have had a meeting. We've discussed the offer, and I have to inform you, there's no way we're willing to accept legs in the air.
Herbert Marcuse became a popular philosopher among students for his book One Dimensional Man, which included the theory that sex in a field was better than in the home or car, because in a field you're not distracted by capitalist technology. I pity his missus. He must have been getting halfway through, looking across the living room and going, oh, yeah, I must get the Hoover fixed. Then in 1967, there was the publication of Oz magazine. Oz was packed with headlines like, "Join the sexual revolution, fill your life with new sensations," and "An orgasm a day keeps the psychiatrist away." And it was so 1960s, like when they put on a play about the repressive nature of education outside of school, and their report on it ended, "The fuzz arrived and made it clear we'd be busted, so we split." They may have only been a minority of the population reading Oz and Liberating Masturbation, but the trends were affecting everybody. Now polite society went mad. They'd say things like, "Do you know, I saw a student walking along today? He had hair down to his knees and a great big bushy beard. I couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman." And to realise quite how extraordinary all of this must have seemed, you've just got to remember it was only 6 years since In Search of Charm, which was never likely to say,
"Do remember to read the important parts of modern books. I knew a girl who travelled every day from Tunbridge to London and was delighted one day when a nice young man struck up a conversation. Until he remarked, "Isn't it fascinating about masturbation being so liberating?" Masturbation liberating, she thought. But she didn't have a clue. Do you see?
The hypocrisy of all the old values had been exposed when John Profumo had been caught with call girls, and now all sorts of unlikely people were being swept along in this tide of sexuality. One of the lawyers who defended Oz magazine was Leon Britton. In 1967, the changing attitudes had political consequences. An act legalising abortion was introduced by David Steele, despite a petition circulated that said, "This act will make King Herod laugh in hell." In the same year was the Homosexuality Act. The Wolfenden Report on Homosexuality in the 50s estimated that half of all blackmail cases involve gay men. So although the act removed the threat of being jailed for being gay, the thinking behind it wasn't particularly liberal. For example, even Leo Absey, who was a sponsor of the bill, said,
"All we want is for these sad people to be able to live out their unfortunate condition discreetly."
But the moment when the sexual revolution began to transcend itself was 1968, when it stopped being mainly about sex and became a catalyst for massive political changes. For in that year were four huge events, all of which fed off of each other. An enormous movement opposed the war in Vietnam. The civil rights movement in America exploded with the formation of the armed Black Panther movement. Russian tanks crushed a reform movement in Prague, which dissuaded the new generation of activists from following the Communist Party. And there was France. France, like Britain, had undergone a huge growth in the number of students. At one campus in Nanterre, on the outskirts of Paris, the authorities had a rule that male students weren't allowed into the women's residences. So, to protest, in March 1968, thousands of students took part in peaceful invasions of the women's quarters. A handful of students in Nanterre were inspired by their campaign, so they organised a day of anti-imperialist discussion about Vietnam. But the authorities sent the riot police in to close the lecture hall. Eventually, a national student strike was called. Students built barricades, fought pitch battles with the police, and appealed to car workers to come out on strike as well. And by May 1968, France was in the middle of the biggest general strike in history. And all because a few weeks earlier, one student had said, "Do you know what? I'm desperate for a shag." But the movements affected each other in other ways. The comment credited with igniting a mass women's movement was made by Stokely Carmichael, a Black Panther, who was asked at a conference what the position of women in the black movement should be and said, "Prone." Militant women's groups started springing up all over America. The first and most obvious protest was against Miss America, especially as one of the winner's duties would be to visit the troops in Vietnam. The English movement, while different to the American one in some ways, did have one similarity. One of their first demonstrations was against Miss World, held at the Albert Hall. The way women were described in Miss World was typified by the commentator who said about one contestant,
"And apparently this one can cook too. My word, too good to be true."
But at the contest in November 1970, some women sneaked into the audience, and on the signal of one of them twirling a football rattle, the others launched bags of flour over Bob Hope, who was presenting. So Bob rushed off the stage, was ushered back on by Eric Morley, but then was stuck for anything to say, because no one had written any cue cards for the eventuality of guerrilla action with a bag of flour. So he said, "For people to spoil a beautiful occasion like this, they must be on drugs." Though you can't help thinking that if instead of chucking flour they'd have been throwing napalm, he'd have done a free concert for them. In America, just as the women's movement had sprung from the Civil Rights for Blacks campaign, another movement would spring from the women's groups. Betty Friedan, founder of the National Organization of Women, had referred to lesbians in the movement as the Lavender Menace. But gay men were in a marginally better position than in Britain, as they did have a few bars in the major cities in which they could be openly gay. And the most famous of these was in Greenwich Village, New York, called the Stonewall Inn. In 1966, this was taken over by Mario Zucchi and Fat Tony, three gays in the mafia. It's hard to imagine a gay Greenwich Village mafia.
"Well, if you ask me, it's time we took out the Tartalias. Have you seen what they've been wearing lately, for Christ's sake? I tell you, they're bringing gangsters into disrepute."
"Oh, police, stop getting all cocked up. I'm dealing with them."
"Why? What did you do? Steal their Barbara Streisand tickets?"
"I made the head of the family an offer he couldn't refuse."
"Oh, you flatter yourself."
The bar was expensive, the drinks were watered down, and although the police were being paid off, they still raided it frequently and made huge profits for the mob. One summer night in 1969, the police raided the place as usual, at which point the gay men started striking up poses as they were arrested. But a lesbian who was put into a police van climbed straight out of the other side and started rocking the van. The police started truncheoning her and a riot started. Fire hydrants were ripped up, bricks were brought down from a building site, and the police were pelted with weapons. Deputy Inspector Pine said,
"I've been in combat situations, but I've never been as scared as I was then."
The tactical patrol force set up to deal with Vietnam demonstrations were called out, but they were also forced to retreat, at which point dozens of queens formed a chorus line in front of the burning building, singing, "We are the Stonewall Girls, we wear our hair in curls, we wear no underwear, we show our pubic hair, we wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees." Only gays could be halfway through a riot and then decide to write a musical about it. The riot lasted 3 days, with each retreat by the police being followed by more forces returning. At one point, an officer said repeatedly to one gay, "I'd like to break your ass wide open," until the gay replied, "What a Freudian comment, officer." And what I love about that is that at some point over the next few days, that copper will have been up the library looking through the Encyclopedia Britannica. Going, "Freud, Freud, 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 Freud." "You bastard!" Inspired by the American movement, gays in Britain formed a Gay Liberation Front, the GLF. Since the 1967 Legalisation Act, gays had been able to come out, but attitudes were much the same as before. A typical newspaper article said, 10 ways to spot a homosexual, with suede shoes being cited as the dead giveaway. Again, it was those who'd been supporting the Vietnam demonstrations and the Black Panthers who formed the groups. One of the first campaigns formed by the GLF was the Counter-Psychiatry Group, which opposed a book by the psychiatrist David Rubin, in which he claimed that gays were mentally ill. This also followed the American group, who'd invaded a convention of psychiatrists who'd been arguing the same thing. But a demonstration against psychiatrists must be one of the most peculiar types of demonstration you could imagine. You'd be chanting, "Fascist pig!" And they'd be going, "Do you find that shouting is a release for you?" There were weekly meetings in Notting Hill of 500 people, and a campaign to get pubs to serve gays was started, called A Pint of Creme de Menthe. Again, they copied the Americans who'd been going into homophobic bars in New York saying, "We are homosexuals and we would like a drink." But the difference the English group must have had, I would have thought, is that in central London, it's impossible for anyone to get served. The locals must have been stood there watching this going, "Oh, yeah. Seems to work." "Sexual, I'd like a drink." And then maybe some of them got a bit cocky, and at 1 minute past 11, when the landlord's going, "Come along now, get out, we are homosexuals and we'd like a lock in." There was a campaign to defend an underground magazine called the International Times, which was prosecuted for running gay contact adverts. The trial was part of an attempted backlash against the sexual revolution. Oz was also prosecuted for publishing a pornographic version of Rupert Bear. Groups in society that cherished traditional values started to fight back. The so-called family life had to be saved and women had to be told to remember their place and listen to Jimmy Young's Housewife's Choice on Radio 2. In particular, an organisation called the Festival of Light was formed by two Christian missionaries with the declared aim of stopping Britain's moral decline and was fronted by Mary Whitehouse, Malcolm Muggeridge, Lord Longford and Cliff Richard. Can there ever have been an organisation involving four more peculiar people? In September 1971, the Festival of Light organised a rally in London with beacons lit across the country to commemorate it, but GLF members forged tickets and got their members to attend. Then, when an evangelist called Joan Gibbons started speaking,
"We released thousands of white mice. Two elderly women suddenly unfurled a banner saying, 'Cliff for Queen!'" "It became total mayhem as the incidents piled up into each other."
Now, the Festival of Light was disrupted not just because it was anti-gay, but because it was in opposition to everything that had sparked off in 1968. But also, here was the problem for women's and gay groups. As long as they were connected to the movements to change society, they had an impact. But as the 70s went on, the Americans pulled out of Vietnam, the civil rights movement began to decline, and most feminists and gay activists started turning inwards and getting obsessed with their own behaviour. Much of the Gay Liberation Front, for example, ended up living in communes. The gay and women's movements did have two problems. Firstly, they thought that by cutting themselves off from oppressive people, they could be liberated, but all that happened then was inevitable bickering. So the process which had brought the movements together went into reverse. Eventually, ideas which at the height of the movement were thought of as mad began to be taken seriously. For example, the statement quoted by Sarah Evans.
Women are in a colonial relationship to men, and we recognise ourselves as part of the Third World.
But they were right the first time. It's mad. Otherwise, most houses would be like this.
Oh, dearest, I need another 10 quid to pay the milkman.
All right, all right. Now hurry up and get me cash crops ready.
They won't be long, dear.
What do you mean, won't be long? I told you I want 40 tonnes of cocoa on the table every day by 5:18.
Then came the women-only conferences that had burst into mayhem of, oh, get him out, there's a man in the room, get him out, he's oppressing me. And some poor woman would go, well, sorry, he's only 6 months old and I can't get a babysitter. In the end, most of the women's movement ended up like a surreal play at the Edinburgh Festival, standing outside nuclear bases with mirrors to reflect the evil back into the camp. As we've seen, the battle to change attitudes towards sexuality wasn't just about sex. Women and gays weren't just demanding rights, but the right to take part in the battle for a different world altogether. It was as if they were screaming at the upheavals of the 60s, you can't do it without us. One of the high points of the gay movement, for example, was when the leader and founder of the Black Panthers, Huey Newton, said, we must relate to the homosexual movement because it is a real thing. Although the movement subsequently declined, they had set in motion changes in society that haven't been reversed. Middle-class women in particular have benefited from the fallout of the 60s, able to pursue careers in business, the media and the law. And so that's the story of 30 years of the women's movement. From chucking flour at Miss World and campaigning for night cleaners to Sherry Blair. But if there's one statistic which sums up the effect of the sexual revolution, it's this. According to a survey, in 1962, the average duration of the sex act was 4 minutes. But by 1987, this had grown to 10 minutes. Which shows how much has changed, but also how far there is to go. Because every man in the world, no matter how radical or sensitive or political, will respond to that survey in one of two ways. Either, oh, Christ. Or, yes!
The Mark Steele Revolution was written and presented by Mark Steele with the help of Carla Mendonca and Martin Heider. The broadcast assistant was Sean Lord, and the producer was Bill Clark.